Being from the South, I know a thing or two about how bugs can ruin a great outdoor experience. It's crazy how something so small can affect some of the potentially greatest experiences of your life. And that's why today's show is brought to you in part by Sawyer. You might know them as the water filter company. I actually have a couple Sawyer filters, but they make a lot of other great products too, including their insect repellent. And just some points about what it is. It's great for the whole family. It's actually safe to use on infants and those who are pregnant because they don't use DEET, the active ingredient. They use something better called picaridin. It actually lasts longer. It lasts up to 12 hours. Pretty incredible. And it doesn't damage any of your gear. So it's insect repellent specifically made for families who are also outdoorsy because it won't ruin any of that high dollar gear that you've bought to be out there. And it does a fantastic job of protecting you and your family from those vector-borne illnesses that are carried by insects. I know for me, I'm always carrying some insect repellent because I've had mosquitoes specifically ruin some pretty incredible backpacking experiences. Don't let it happen to you. Use Sawyer's 20% picaridin insect repellents. Find out more about that at sawyer.com. Play safe, travel safely. Sawyer, they keep you outdoors.
But what's super cool about this cave is that it's in the middle of a lake that, you know, it looks like a normal lake, but you would never know that about 35 feet or so beneath that lake surface is a super beautiful cave that's just, it's just unbelievable.
This is the Adventure Sports Podcast, where we hear stories of adventure from every corner of the planet. We interview all sorts of folks who are using their sport to explore the world around them and give you the inspiration you need to get out there and have some fun. Hey folks, happy Thursday. Today's episode is a throwback to a few years ago when Kurt was the host. He's doing this episode, and it's all about cave diving. You know, it's something I've never done. It's something I knew that existed, tons of caves around the world, and obviously down here in the Southeast, there's a lot. And yeah, it's definitely a terrifying, totally different world, and can be terrifying. But this episode, Josh is going to show us kind of the beauty of it and kind of the excitement behind it and how you can try it out and get involved and maybe give it a shot yourself. At the very least, it's very interesting. So I hope you enjoy, and you'll be hearing from us with a brand new episode on Monday.
Hi, friends. Thank you again for listening to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I've got a great guest for you today. Joshua Schaus is here to talk about cave diving. I have been wanting to do a cave diving episode for a long, long time, and Josh stepped up to the plate for us. I don't know why, but it's been tough to find a cave diver to be on the show. Josh is in Louisville, Kentucky. He started scuba diving about 4 years ago and got into cave diving pretty quickly. He's been doing cave diving for about 3 years, and man, he is tearing it up. He has over 160 cave dives already, so quite a lot of experience for such a short period of time. I am really excited to pick his brain about an adventure sport that we have not yet talked about on the Adventure Sports Podcast. So Josh, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Pretty excited to be able to talk about it.
Oh, yeah, it's really, really cool. I don't even know where to start almost. I think we should start with scuba, just the scuba 101 thing. We've done several shows on scuba diving, and so our listeners can go back, and I say this almost every show, but if you go to the adventuresportspodcast.com, at the top there's a link for episode categories. So if you click that link, then all of our shows are listed there. If you do a control F, then that will allow you to put in any term you want or a person's name, and you can find the show. So if you want a more in-depth show about just scuba diving, like ocean diving in particular, then maybe go there. Today, we're going to spend most of our time on cave diving. But Josh, let's talk about scuba at the beginning, just for those who don't know about scuba and haven't heard those earlier shows. Let's start here. Why did you take up scuba diving?
So I was in college, getting my first degree, and I went to school with my brother, and we were both kind of looking for a easy class and that we could take together and make it easier for studying and whatnot. But they offered a scuba diving course. We both thought that that was super cool. And so we took that course. It was over a semester long, and I think it was about every other week or so we would go to the pool and do skills and learn how to breathe off regulators and assemble your gear and whatnot. And then we would eventually at the end of the semester, you would complete what's called your confined water portion. And that doesn't necessarily give you the ability to go scuba diving just yet. So it comes in two parts, and maybe I'm touching on things before we get there, but you then have to go down to what they call open water, and that can be oceans or lakes, quarries, things like that, where you then do essentially the same skills, but just in open water in front of the instructors. And then that's how you get your open water course.
So, you know, I've heard about weekend programs where you go long days and it takes about 3 days and you're certified. You did it over a longer period of time through college, which actually is better because you get more time to kind of get used to everything you need to know. But what do you think are the key skills that are super critical before someone starts scuba diving?
Well, you know, a lot of people think that that you got to be a good swimmer to scuba dive. And that's one of the big myths. But you actually don't really have to be a good swimmer at all. The critical skills, I mean, I feel like it's such a different sport that you really just need to be in, you know, halfway decent shape and open to new things. The first time you breathe underwater is pretty cool. Seems like most people have trouble removing their mask underwater and then putting it back on. That's probably the skill that causes most people the issues when they're training. So maybe get used to having your eyes exposed in open water would maybe be the best skill to practice if they were wanting to school through the course easy.
It's interesting that you say that. A lot of people think, well, I'm no good in water, I better not scuba. But everyone that I've talked to that trains people to scuba dive, they say, really, that's not the case. A lot of people that don't like water, it's because of not being able to look around in the water. They don't like the water on their eyes, you know. And so getting the mask off might be the challenge, but the mask actually provides them with a comfort level to enjoy the water that maybe wasn't a comfortable thing for them, you know, just as a swimmer. So a lot of people that don't really like water that much find that they really love scuba diving. It's kind of a weird thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did a little bit of teaching for a little while, and I helped teach with some like open water classes, and it never failed that every time we would go to the part where we would have everybody pull their masks off, there would be at least one person that would bolt up to the surface just because I guess they were really comfortable with the mask on, and as soon as you pull it off, they feel the water touching their nose and it scares them and they think that they can't breathe anymore, so they just bolt up to the surface.
Yeah, and bolting to the surface is probably the one thing you don't want to do. So it's a good idea to get used to that a little bit. But probably, like you're saying, that may be the biggest challenge for most people to overcome.
Yeah, seems like that's been my experience.
So, you know, as a cave diver, you're doing a lot of freshwater diving. And I think a lot of people think about saltwater diving because, you know, that's where the coral, you know, that is, that's where the beautiful fish are and all that kind of stuff. But what's freshwater diving like?
Freshwater diving it's the best. I am not a fan of ocean water, just the salt and everything. I've done some saltwater diving, of course, but the freshwater diving is awesome because usually there's less, you have some different buoyancy characteristics, which is always nice. All of your gear, when you go dive in like the ocean, needs to be rinsed off because of all the salt and everything can cause some issues. So fresh water is, especially like from springs and such, is about as clean as it gets. And you're able to just kind of hop right out. You don't really have to rinse off your gear or anything. So fresh water has some definite pros. It maybe isn't as clear as some of the oceans in the salt water, but you don't have to have any kind of nasty salt water in your mouth.
Yeah. So that's another advantage, I guess, for fresh water. Interesting. You know, I started scuba diving back in college, much like yourself, actually in high school, but I ended up taking a college course as well and did a lot of diving when I was in Oklahoma. So that was years ago. Did a little saltwater diving, did a lot of freshwater diving. And then when I moved to Colorado, I got so busy with other sports, I haven't done it as much, but I still love it. It's just been a little bit less convenient for me. But something a lot of people don't know, and that I experienced, I'm sure you have, a lot of these reservoirs, they didn't cut the trees down. And so where the water's deep enough, when you dive down, the trees are still standing. They may have been there for 50, 60, 75 years, but they're still supple and they're still standing. So you can scuba dive through a forest.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the coolest thing.
Yeah, that's we have a few quarries around in Kentucky that have some, exactly what you're saying, some standing trees that it's just cool to be able to hover over top of those and be able to, it kind of looks like a forest that you're just kind of flying over top of. Really, really cool.
So what's your favorite part about scuba diving? Some people like to be able to see the saltwater fish. Some people like the freedom of movement, you know, the feeling that you are flying. What's your favorite?
My favorite is that it's just such a novel environment that there's nothing like it. It's just truly peaceful. You're able to, you know, essentially fly through the water. It's pretty effortless. It's so hard to compare it to anything else. And it's just such a nice sport. And you're able to go see places that, you know, very few people, if anyone at all, ever will see in their lives. And there's something to say about that too.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should dive into the cave diving part of this. I didn't mean to make a pun there, but so cave diving, now that scares a lot of people. And here's the reason. When you're scuba diving, if something goes wrong, the surface is, you know, the escape route. When you're cave diving, up isn't out necessarily. And so that adds a new element to scuba diving that it scares me a little bit. I'm sure that other people are kind of like, oh, you're underground and underwater at the same time. I mean, I'm thinking about claustrophobia. I'm thinking about, you know, you really got to be on your game. You don't want to be deep in a cave and run out of air. Holy cow. So tell us a little bit about cave diving. What makes it special or different from just your open water diving?
Yeah, that's kind of the impression that most cave divers get when you tell somebody that you cave dive is they think it's, you know, the most dangerous thing ever. And, you know, you did a show not too long ago about dangerous aspects, and we always joke and say that the most dangerous part about cave diving is driving to the dive site.
Right.
And, you know, as you said, you know, if we have issues, we can't just surface. We pretty much have to deal with the issue there. And that's where it takes quite a bit of training to get to the level where you're cave diving. You work on a lot of skills that, you know, help you to adequately, you know, deal with any issues that you have underwater. We are extremely conservative with our air supply. We use what's called the thirds rule, where we use one third going into the cave, we use one third going out, and then we have one third for emergency. And that's the minimum that you should have. You know, a lot of I plan most of my dives with a little bit more conservancy than that, just because when you do have problems, that one third is likely not actually enough to help you get out safely. And then you tack on a buddy, and you both have, you know, you have a friend to help you get through some issues. You also have, you know, his gas supply as well to help you if one of your tanks decides to just start leaking air or whatever. So it's a lot of training, a lot of practice, but it's a pretty safe sport. There's really nothing like it, in my opinion.
Well, just my biased opinion, I really love scuba diving because I like that feeling of flight. I like the weightlessness. I like being able to see animals of every shape, color, even things that, I mean, they look like they're from another planet. Just amazing animal life that you see, you know, under the oceans. And the even in the freshwater, I see fish that blow my mind. Just beautiful things you don't catch on a hook because they're not that kind of a fish. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I love all of that about it. But then if you add the exploration of an underwater cave, scuba diving to me is fun and I love it. But for me personally, I spent so much time in the water, there's not a real excitement factor. It's just a very enjoyable factor. But you throw a cave into that, I get excited. I mean, that gets the adrenaline pumping for me. So I don't know. Does it do that for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you'll see some photos of some really beautiful springs. And, you know, especially down in Florida, there's a ton of them. And you just, most people will ever, all they'll ever see is this beautiful hole of you know, crystal clear water. And most will always wonder, you know, what's down there. And when you're, you know, a cave diver, you're able to, you know, go find out what's down there. And that's what's just, it's just so cool. And it's just unbelievable what you can find down in these caves. And it's, you know, as you're saying, you know, you see these fish that just blow your mind. Well, you know, we'll see humongous passage and these rock formations and clay banks that just are just pristine and beautiful. And, you know, and you may be the first to ever see this and to be there. And that's just what, it's just really cool.
Wow. So the exploration aspect of it is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't imagine what it's like to go somewhat deep into one of these flooded caverns. I mean, like you say, I'm envisioning myself looking into some of these giant springs and seeing the clear water until it goes black. And I look in that, and it scares me and entices me at the same time.
Yeah, I think that so exploring caves is you know, like a section of the cave diving that I would say a lot of cave divers don't do, but they would like to. I have been fortunate to be able to be kind of mentored by a lot of divers and to help, you know, learn how to safely explore caves. And I think it, because it adds a big, it adds a level of, I guess, if you will, danger to the sport. You're going places that are, people have never gone. You are, you know, so we use a, we always have a continuous guideline to the surface, and that, you know, helps you prevent yourself from getting lost in the cave, you know, because some of these caves are like labyrinths, and, you know, there's the passages look the same. And if you, you know, turn around and you're like, well, did I come out this way or did I go out this way? And so we always have a continuous guideline throughout the cave. And so like the caves in Florida that have already been explored, they have this line in place. It's there permanently. It never goes anywhere. But when you're exploring new caves, you are the one laying that line. And so you have to make sure you put it in a way that, you know, you can see it and you can follow it out, with what we call zero visibility. So, you know, if a lot of the caves, the ground is made up of this fine silt that is, just mud. And if you touch it, it just puffs out like smoke, and in a matter of seconds you can have no, you can't see anything. And so you have to be able to follow that line out in zero visibility, and you know, it should be able to take you out to the surface to where, you know, once it ends, it, all you have to do is continue on up to the surface and you should be in, you know, open air.
So wild.
The exploration part is definitely, it's a little bit level of danger, but it can, you know, it can be safely done as well.
You know, when I was diving, like I said, 20 years ago or more, I went down to Jenny Springs, Florida. And I'm sure you've probably done a lot of dives around there.
Sure have, yeah.
Yeah. So at the time, they had one cave where there were no passageways that you could get lost in. They had it, the only passageway that you might have was sealed off with a metal gate so you couldn't go in. So they would let any diver take a light in there and look around because it's just one big open, you know, cave, and you could pretty much swim up and out. That's about all there was to it. The other caves, they said you can't take a light unless you're cave certified. You can't take a light, but you can go into the mouth of the cave and swim around where, as long as you can see the exit. And so we did some of that. And that was really amazing to me. But then the idea that I could flip on a light and just keep going and going and going, that just blows my mind.
Yeah. And Chitty is one of the more popular caves. It's the, so what you're talking about is sometimes referred to like as Chitty Spring. It's the, they have that grate in the back that keeps people from going back there. And then over where you're talking about is the Devil's Cave system, which technically has two windows into it. And I mean, it's probably the most popular cave in Florida. The visibility is always pretty much crystal clear. There's lots and lots of passage there. And it's just has everything from big open passage to small stuff where you're crawling through. It's just a beautiful cave. But you know, that's also attracts a lot of people that, aren't cave certified that, you know, like to go down in those caves like you're talking about, and they'll bring a light and maybe go in and they're not actually supposed to be in there.
Yikes. So, well, let's talk about cave certification. You've also already said that it's really important to know what to watch out for when you're cave diving. It's not the same as open water diving. So how do you get cave certified?
So you obviously you got to be open water scuba certified. There's a few different training agencies, Technical Diving Institute, and National NSSCDS, which is the National Speleological Society Cave Diving Section, are two of the big ones. They each kind of have different requirements, but as a general kind of rule of thumb, you get what's called an advanced diver certification, and that like allows you to go a little bit deeper. You should have Nitrox certification, which is like an enriched oxygen. So like, you know, the air we breathe is 21%. Well, Nitrox is anything over 21%. So like a common one is 30% Nitrox. And it just, it allows you to be able to stay down longer without having the nitrogen building up in your body. And then pretty much after that, you can take what's called cavern diver, and that allows you to go in the cave, within like daylight, as you said. So as long as you can see daylight, you can, ponder around in there and look around in the cave. And cavern diver, it's really the foundation for a cave diver. It's one of the most important classes. It's where you learn how to run a reel from the surface. It's, you know, buoyancy and lights and signals and all that stuff. So after you do that, you then have a class called like intro to cave diver, which is where you actually go beyond that light zone and you start actually going into the cave. The major change is that you get to go beyond that light daylight zone, and then you use 1/6 roll, which is, so you're only using 1/6 of your gas supply. You then use 1/6 coming out, and then you have that remaining for emergencies. And that's just to allow a whole lot of room for if you have issues at that early period of your cave diving experience. From there, you go into what's called apprentice cave diver, and that allows you to begin using that 1/3 roll. And it allows you to, continue on further into the cave, go a little bit further when you're using, 1/3 of your gas supply. The major restriction is that it doesn't allow you to jump off of what we call the main line or the gold line. And, cause there's a cave has like, what we call like the main passage. But then there's all these other small passages off that. As an apprentice cave diver, you can only stay in that main passage, and then you just come right back out. And finally, when you get enough experience and you get some dives under your belt, which at that level, you can take full cave diver, which is where you can jump over to these other passages to where you can do deeper dives and those kind of things. And that kind of gives you what they call the certification to learn. So now, you can go cave diving, you know, but it's not the, you know, you still have a lot you can learn from. And then there's a lot of technical courses from there that you can take that allow you to give, to use different breathing gases, like what we call trimix, which is where they use helium. And then that allows you to go deeper. You can tack on, rebreathers. You can tack on what we call diver propulsion vehicles, which are scooters. And these are these torpedo looking things that propel you through the water. It's just there's a lot of different classes after you finish that, you know, initial cave diving certification that you can continue learning with.
So I've got to ask some of the questions that I know people must be thinking about. You know, you mentioned that you have this main guideline that you're taking in. And I think about the Hansel and Gretel story. What happens if the line gets cut? Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, that happens, you know, and people, what will happen is you'll be diving along and somehow it never fails. It gets stuck in some piece of your gear, your fin, your harness or something. And you can't get it out and you have to cut the line in order to get it out. You're taught in your cave training, you know, what you do if you get caught in the line. And you are taught, you know, if you have to cut it, that you how to repair it and put it back. So it's definitely, and then of course, you know, that comes back to when whoever initially runs the line has to make sure that they run it in a manner that it's kind of out of the way, that you're not getting caught on it, and that it's not going to get cut on some sharp rocks or anything like that.
So it's all a part of the plan.
Yeah, yeah. So you got to be prepared for pretty much everything.
This is the best time to move to the mountain town of your dreams. COVID-19 has changed the way the world works and probably the way you work. I know that I work more remotely now that all this has happened. So why not live somewhere that you want to, in a mountain paradise that you've always dreamed of? Well, the Gunnison Valley in Colorado is that perfect place. It's nestled right between a bunch of mountains, all sorts of things to do. There's over 750 miles of biking and hiking single track. Crested Butte right there in the valley has world-class skiing, and the whole county has an award-winning school system. So imagine waking up in your ultimate destination every single morning. No traffic, no crowded trails, no more wishing you lived in the mountains like I do. Work where you play in the Gunnison Valley. They'll be able to help you make that mountain dream come true at icelab.co. That's icelab.co. And consider the Gunnison Valley your new home.
You know, another thing is you keep talking about gas mixes that allow you to stay in a little longer, go a little deeper. We might as well touch on that. Just in scuba, they're really, I mean, there's several dangers, but the I call them the big two. One is that you go too deep for too long and you have to deal with the potential for the bends, right, when you surface. The other is holding your breath and actually rupturing an air sac in your lungs, an air embolism. So you never hold your breath, you don't go too deep for too long, you're in pretty good shape. Scuba diving, really, those two rules, you know, that takes care of the majority of the risk. But when you're cave diving and you're going deeper and you're using these other gases, how does that play in?
Yeah, so when you get to the level where you're, when you're cave diving deeper and longer, you're going to get into what they call decompression. And that's kind of what you just talked about, where if you stay down for a long time and you just come straight to the surface, you can get, you know, the bends, or you can get bent. And that's where the nitrogen that's in your body is causing issues with like normal tissue function. And so what we do, okay, I would say most cave divers, they plan their dives before they go in. They kind of know, okay, well, this is where we're going, this is how much air we're going to use, this is what our decompression will be, and they bring all the gas required for that, and then some, you know, for emergencies. And so we use dive computers that and different programs that help us know, okay, if we're going to be down, you have what's called a no decompression limit. And so you can say, well, okay, my no decompression limit is 30 minutes at this depth. If I stay longer than 30 minutes, I then have to decompress before I just go to the surface. And so you have what's called a deco stop. And you have, and usually you stop at a certain depth for a certain amount of time, and you are then able to go to the surface after you finish your deco stop. So dive computers have advanced a lot. There's a lot of fancy ones out there. And you take a dive computer and it measures your depth and your time. And it's based off various algorithms that tell us, okay, if we're, you know, doing this dive to this depth, this is how much deep, this is how much time you need to spend at your deco stop and at this depth. And so the longer you do the dives, or the longer dives and the deeper they are, the more decompression you have to do. So you should know about how much decompression you're going to have before you enter the water, because that way you know how much decompression, how much air you need to bring in order to do that decompression. So then what you can do is you can speed up your decompression by using different breathing gases. So like oxygen, most of us will bring 100% oxygen to our decompression stops, and that'll allow us to breathe in only oxygen instead of any more nitrogen, and we're off-gassing all of the nitrogen, and we're taking on no more in our body. So every exhale we do, we're getting rid of nitrogen, and we're inhaling only oxygen. But the catch is, if you're breathing 100% oxygen, you can only, the max depth you can breathe that at is really about 20 feet. So on a normal average dive, you know, we're just maybe going to no deeper than say like 100 feet. You would stop at about 20 feet and do your decompression stop, where you could then throw in, you could start breathing your oxygen, and you can just off gas all that nitrogen much quicker than if you were just breathing your 30% nitrox mix. And so then you talk about what we call trimix. And that's where you involve helium, nitrogen, and oxygen. And the goal there is to decrease the amount of nitrogen and replace it with helium. And as well as you can decrease the levels of oxygen to, depending on the depth, of course. It kind of gets really technical, so I'm trying to be very
superficial. This is amazing stuff. Keep going.
So you can alter the levels of the gases depending on the depth to ultimately decrease the amount of nitrogen that you are taking in. So that way you can reduce the amount of decompression that you have to do. And so you can actually, you know, have what's called a hypoxic mix, which means that, so the air we breathe is 21%. You can have like a 18 or 15% mix, which is that 18 or 15% oxygen and then, you know, some helium and some nitrogen in that mix, but you can't really breathe that at the surface because it's what's called hypoxic.
Right.
It doesn't have enough, per se oxygen to, actually breathe that at the surface. So, but once you get down to like, you know, depths where the planned depth that you plan to go to, you can then breathe it in, because what happens is, as you go down in depth, the gas compresses, and so you have more, you have a higher what's called partial pressure, and so it allows you, the molecules are kind of crunched together more so that you can actually breathe that mix, and it is enough for your body to breathe. So with that being said, you're able to, you know, again, reduce that decompression with a hypoxic mix. But that's usually, most people that are doing that are going, you know, in excess of 150, 200 feet deep.
Pretty deep stuff. We should probably mention narcosis and then move on to the fun of this.
Okay, sure.
What you just illustrated for us, though, is that there is a lot to learn and a lot of things that can be done to change the experience. And I like that. I love a sport where, you know, you can get started in it relatively easily, and then there's just a long learning curve after that where you can keep on learning more and more and experiencing new things. So that's really, really awesome. But what's narcosis?
So narcosis is, I guess in short, it's people compare it to like drinking a few martinis is what it's mostly compared to. And so if you have... I can remember when I first started scuba diving, we were diving at a spring in Florida called Blue Grotto, and it has a deep section in the back that goes down to about 100 feet. And we were breathing air, so 21%, and then the rest of that is nitrogen, mostly nitrogen. So then you've got about, I guess, 79-ish percent of nitrogen. And what happens is that nitrogen is inert to us, so it doesn't really do anything bad for us, but it can cloud, like, your vision. So when you go down to depth and you're breathing, you have all that nitrogen, you start to have what's called nitrogen narcosis. And it just kind of makes you, it does different things to different people. For me, I feel, you can start to feel a little, I don't know, strange. You start kind of honing in on certain things. It can cause anxiety. It slows things down for me, depending on the depth, where it almost feels like everything gets quiet, and every move you're doing, it's like watching yourself in slow-mo. And so that's kind of what it just alters your mental status in a way that's similar to, you know, drinking a few martinis.
Sounds like a good time to head up.
Yeah. And that's why the term like nitrox and different gas mixes come into play. And if you can reduce that level of nitrogen, you can increase your overall ability to be clear-headed at that depth, as well as decreasing the amount of decompression you have to do. So that's the other added benefit for different gas mixes. Is you know, if you're at 200 feet and you have the least amount of nitrogen as possible, and you've replaced that with helium, then you can be a whole lot more clear-headed. And as you might expect, you want to be as clear-headed as possible at 200 feet deep.
Well, we have had a commercial saturation diver on the show, and I believe he was using Heliox. Of course, he stays saturated for days.
Yeah.
You know, so that he can do big jobs over extended periods of time. And when it comes time then to decompress, it takes days to decompress, which just, that's a whole nother world. But that's not something that generally a cave diver is going to get into.
Yeah, not days of decompression. Yeah, there are some divers out there that are doing you know, upwards of 16-20 hour dives. So they are you know, physically in the water for that long. And you know, that's a whole another talk that right there. But there are some guys that are decompressing for, you know, 10 hours, 12 hours, you know, even longer than that. And and it's just due to the depth and the amount of time that they are diving at. It's just, that's just what they have to do.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
I can't imagine a 10-hour decompression stop. I can't imagine a 1-hour decompression stop. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, they have a lot of inventions that make it easier, like what they call a habitat, which is, if you can imagine, you take a cup and you flip it upside down and you shove it in like a pool of water, and how that air is trapped in there.
Right.
They create a habitat, and they build it down in the water, and they fill it full of air. And then the divers are actually able to come out of the water and set up inside this habitat. They're able to eat and drink and decompress, all while watching an iPad or something. And so they sit in that little habitat, you know, for whatever hours they have to, and they decompress that way. So it's not maybe as bad as you'd expect, but sitting in a room for, you know, more than a few hours, it can probably be pretty daunting.
It just goes to show, it doesn't matter what the sport is, there are people that are going to take it as far as they can, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is kind of the beauty of adventure sports, is that people can take it as far as they can. Wow. You know what? I'd like to get a story from you. I would like to hear about your very first cave dive when you were actually going beyond the surface light. I'd like to know what that was like.
Well, when I first started cave diving after my training, it was pretty kind of scary, I guess, if you will, because, you know, you have been training and practicing all this time, and now there's no longer an instructor or anybody that's watching over you. You know, you are kind of on your own with a buddy. And the first few dives that I did after my training on, you know, my own, were pretty, you know, were really cool, because you felt like it all comes full circle. You know, you'd spent all this time training, and that you had finally reached to the level where you were really doing something. You were on your own. And when you were able to just look around as much, you didn't have to worry about the instructor making you do drills and taking your lights away and pulling you off out of the passage and throwing you over anywhere. I think it was pretty relaxing, but at the same time, it was really intimidating, because, you know, you don't want to mess up. You don't obviously want to have anything go wrong.
Well, it is cool, because what you're describing is what a lot of people experience with any sport. It's when they finally learn how to do it and they're able to, like, go out on their own and try it for the first time. And it's all on them, yeah. You know? Yeah. I think that personal challenge aspect of adventure sports is probably one of the most attractive things about it, even if it's something as simple as learning how to alpine ski. You know, it's that learning curve that is so much fun. It's just innate to what it is to be human, to want to learn new skills and to really enjoy that.
Yeah. I can remember it not being too long, because I was really conservative on my gas. I can remember it not being too technical, because I didn't want to go jump off the main line or anything. And I can remember it being very fulfilling, though, because first cave dive on your own. So that's pretty cool.
Right on. So on Facebook, was it just last week you posted some stuff about a dive you did in Missouri?
It's actually one of my favorite caves. It's a cave called Cannonball Cave. I think the story behind it is that they found a whole bunch of cannonballs down inside the spring that are, I guess they date back to, I don't know, whenever they were using cannonballs. But and now they're posted in the front of the cave now, so you can take a look at them as you crawl through the cave. And what's super cool about this cave is that it's in the middle of a lake. It's in Missouri, southern Missouri. It's in the middle of a lake that, you know, it looks like a normal lake, but you would never know that about, you know, 35 feet or so beneath that lake surface is this super beautiful cave. It's just unbelievable. And it's very interesting how you find the cave. You have to, because the lake water is usually a murky green or brown color, and you pretty much have to, like, there's a few different ways that you can line up with this antenna way in the background, and you can take a reel and you can throw it as far as you can in the water and it should fall, or you can line up with this certain tree on the shore and reel out 75 feet. I mean, there's like a treasure map. Exactly. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can find the spring, and everybody uses kind of their whatever works for them. But on this day, my buddy, he had a reel and he tied it to a tree and he reeled it out at 75 feet. And he has a loop tied in the reel, and then he just drops the spool and it should, you know, fall right into the spring entrance. And so, you know, if it does, then you just kind of have to keep searching around for the cave if you can find it, or you just retry it. And sometimes you don't find it. But luckily on this day, we found it first try. We kind of follow that line down the shore. And before you know it, I mean, you're going through this nasty green water, and then it's like, boom, it's this crystal clear, beautiful lake or spring water. And it's just really, really cool to know that that's like a hidden gem out in this lake. But then even more so is in the back of this cave, about 600 feet in.
Ooh.
is this massive, sorry, 600 horizontal feet, so not deep,
right.
But
six, yeah.
600 horizontal feet in is this pit that's just, I don't know the exact distance. I think it's at least 100 feet in diameter. And it's just it's where the floor disappears and the cave that just swallows your light. You shine your light down and it's just black.
Wow.
You know, and it's just, they have the line ran to where you can go right out to the middle, and then you can drop from about 50 feet to a depth of, you know, close to 300 feet. And it's just this super big pit. And I mean, it just really feels like you're in outer space or something, hovering above this blackness. And you know, it just follows your light. There's just no floor in sight. And we're using really powerful lights, and it's just pitch black. It's the coolest cave, that I've dove, and one of my favorites for sure.
Wow. Well, that raises another question for me. You know, when people go walking through a cave that's above water, they see stalactites and stalagmites. Those things form because there's air for water to drip through.
Yeah.
So I know that some caves are flooded and they still have those formations because the water table was lower at some point in time. But yeah. I imagine a lot of these caves don't have those formations because they've never had the air in there. What's it usually like?
Yeah. So, a lot of the caves, you know, in Florida and in, anywhere pretty much other than, Mexico or, this like kind of the tropical areas, they are all, just limestone caves where there's limestone walls and everything. But there's no, formations really or anything. And that's due to, as you said, the water table was lower at one point and then it rose and it just kind of flooded them out. So all the caves pretty much in Mexico and, like Dominican Republic and, those places all have some really beautiful formations. But most of the caves, you know, in the U.S. are not like that. There are some exceptions, and most of those exceptions are due to it was once a dry cave, but then they dammed a river and it kind of, backs up and then kind of, it floods the cave. And it kind of recharges that spring, and then there are a few formations that way. You'll find there's a cave we dive in Alabama that has a few formations. The cave in southern Tennessee that has a couple formations, but it's always due to some kind of flooding of a dam or something.
Interesting. Another question I have is about current. And you know, I forget exactly where we were. I believe it was just outside of West Plains, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some amazing springs there that have millions of gallons per day that come out of these holes in the ground. And my family and I mean, here's one example. We're driving along. We see that there is supposed to be a spring. So we stopped by the side of the road to look, and there was an old mill that, you know, water wheel that used to grind flour or whatever. And I'm looking for the spring and trying to figure out where the water's coming from to run this mill. And then I realize, wait a minute, the spring is running the mill. There is that much water. The entire spring was just coming out of this mill. And these are massive springs. But that the surface, the water is kind of like churning and boiling because the current is so strong shooting out of the ground that, you know, it's disturbing the surface, even though that's pretty deep. And I guess the reason I bring all that up is that means that there's a crazy current down there. And I can't imagine what it's like to get into those strong currents in a cave and then maybe have to fight your way out. Or do the currents generally try to push you out?
Well, you know, so that brings in like another aspect is you have, you know, most caves are like you're going upstream. So you're swimming upstream and the cave is going to be pushing against you the whole time. And so, like, as you said, Ginny Springs, you would swim, upstream. And so you would be fighting that flow. And then as that flow, is, you know, taking you, working against you on the way in, when you turn around and are exiting, it's actually pushing you out, which is really nice because then you get to pretty much just sit there and not do anything, and it just pushes you right out the cave. But there are also some passages in some caves that have what's called a siphon or even like a downstream. And what that means is that water is going away from the exit. And so it's actually pulling you into the cave.
Ooh.
So something to be, and you would never, well, you shouldn't ever dive. If it's a really strong siphon, you would likely not dive it, or you would dive it with knowing that's the case, and you would have, you would be very conservative, and you would dive in and expect it to be, you know, harder to get out. But as a general rule of thumb, there aren't a whole lot of siphons that people are diving that are sucking you into the cave. They're out there, but people shouldn't be diving in there. They shouldn't be.
Yeah. Wow. That's kind of spooky sounding. I got to relate one story. I interviewed John Fielder a while back, and I used to always ask, and I'm going to ask you in a second because I want to hear it, but tell us about a time that things didn't go right. And I told John Fielder, you might save a life this way. He goes, no, I won't. People always get themselves in trouble, and that's what makes adventure adventure. We learn from our experiences. And I thought, well, I would like to learn from other people's mistakes as much as possible, but here's my mistake. I'm going to throw it out there just because I think it's a crazy story and people should know better. I was diving in a lake and found a little cave entrance under the water. And rule number one that I broke was I was diving alone. Rule number two was that I wasn't cave certified, right? So I broke that rule too. I went into this cave and I obviously wasn't going to go deep. I just want to kind of snoop around a little bit and come back out. Got in there, went through a kind of a narrow passage. It opened up, turned around, said, well, I'm going back out. On the way out, I got stuck. And it actually, the opening was so tight. I didn't know what was hung up, but I wasn't going anywhere. And so I just felt around for a while and finally realized that one of my spare regulator was stuck between my hip and a rock. And so I rotated my hip, moved the regulator, and I was able to swim right back out again. Okay, so yeah. I broke all kinds of rules there. Really, really stupid, right? But that is one of those don't try this tricks.
Yeah.
And it actually shook me up a little bit because I'm like, man, if I got in there and ran out of air and couldn't get out. So what about that? You ever feel like you're going to get trapped in one of these caves? That's like the nightmare scenario.
Yeah, so I knew you were going to ask me this, and I knew there's a story that immediately comes to mind of a cave in Alabama that me and a buddy were diving. And we'd been exploring this cave for a little while, and we had it distance-wise pushed back to almost 5,000 feet, horizontal feet. And we mostly dove it like in the wintertime because we access it through a farm that there's crops in the, you know, in the spring and fall and everything. And so the access is just kind of right through the field where he has his crops. So we can really only get to it when his crops are there in the wintertime. And so, but we had dove it all the time in the winter, and it actually is off of a river that again is dammed up. And so it varies, the depth in the cave varies with the level of the river outside. So we had always dove it in the wintertime, but we went and dove it at a different time of the year and brought what we call scooters, those torpedo things that propel you through the water, because swimming 4,000 feet is a pretty good swim. So you can cut that time in half when you use a scooter that just kind of propels you through the water. And so we thought what we would do was scooter back to the end of our exploration line, and then we would continue on. Well, the water in the cave was lower than it normally was, and so the depth in the cave was already very shallow. You know, we're talking maybe 10 feet deep. Max depth was like 20 feet in one area. And so there was parts where we were pushing the visibility was already not that good. So we maybe had 10 feet of visibility at best. And so we decided we would continue on in the cave. We were saying, you know, even though the visibility is not that good, we'll keep going on. And we're just kind of zooming through. And then we get to this first air bell, because the water is maybe solid 7-10 feet lower than normal. We were actually in dry cave at this point. And it's all muddy bottom, and we're pushing and crawling through this mud, and all of this mud is just going down stream where we have to exit from.
Oh, no.
So it's already hard enough to be crawling through these little air passages with tanks. And we have like three tanks and we have these, you know, heavy scooters and we're just shoving them through the mud. All of our stuff is getting clogged in mud and everything. And we keep going and we keep going. And it takes us like 2 hours to get back to almost the end of where we were at the line. And we knew that when we had to exit, we would be having to go through all of that again. But we had, you know, maybe 10 feet of visibility on the way in. So we could actually kind of see a little bit. Well, on the way out, we knew we were likely going to have no visibility. So we were going to have to hold on to that line for, you know, about 4,000 feet and head out. And it was at that point I knew that I was like, we should not have dove in here in the first place. But I told my friend, I said, I'm going to head out because it's going to probably take another 2 hours to get out of here. And sure enough, it did. And I mean, it took, I think we were total underwater time was, well, in the cave time, we weren't really underwater totally, but in the cave, we were almost 5 hours. And our going back out, tons and tons of things were going wrong. Like, you know, we were trying to scooter out, but we couldn't really scooter because of the depth and we were hitting all the sides of the mud. And the line was not ran in probably the best way. And all it was going to take for was the line to get caught up in the scooter. And then we were going to have another problem there. My scooter got stuck on at one point when I was trying to turn a corner and I had to run it into the wall and get it to, I was smacking the mud, it got clogged in the throttle. And I was having to smack it really hard and get it to come out. And so it was just, we finally made it out. I kept telling myself, man, if I just make it out of here, I'm never going to do that again. But we made it out. We didn't really have a ton of issues. It just took a long time. And we had plenty of air because it was very shallow. And so we had plenty of air. That was never really a concern. I did have a regulator free flow because it got all muddy. That was a very interesting dive, though, and I learned a lot from that one for sure.
Lots of exploration there, it sounds like. But, man, that's spooky stuff. So when you think back on that, is it really still kind of a scary experience for you? Or is it, well, we learned a lot and everything turned out okay?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, we learned a whole lot. And we didn't get anything done, which is never fun. But we both made it out and had an awesome story, went and got some good food. So it was a big learning lesson. So it's still a little spooky when you keep thinking about all the fine details, but you know, that's just part of it.
Wow. Yeah, that one sounds scary to me just because the amount of exertion involved and you're just not sure how quickly you can even get out of there. I mean, if you're having to hang on to a rope and run a scooter at the same time, how do you do that?
It's really hard to scooter and hold the line at the same time. So really I was holding the line and pushing the scooter in front of me. Normally you would take the scooter and you would tie it off behind you and you would tow it kind of behind you. But I was afraid that it was going to get caught up in the line or in a crack or something. And that I couldn't already see to begin with. I felt more comfortable pushing it ahead of me than I did letting it tow behind me. There would become periods of in the cave where visibility would kind of get a little bit better and I could actually see the line. So I would then begin scootering really slow and where I could, you know, I was only maybe a foot away from the line so that I could see the line and I could see, you know, where I was going in the cave for, you know, the next 5 feet or so. And then, you know, the visibility would turn back to next to nothing. And then you would just stop the scooter, grab the line, and then continue on pushing through.
Oh,
so
that doesn't sell me on cave diving, Josh. I'm telling you that doesn't sound like my cup of tea right there.
It's not all like that though. You know, it's like I said, that's a, you know, exploring caves and stuff is a little bit different than, you know, just cave diving in general, you know, down in Florida, there's some really beautiful, incredible caves, you know, big cave too. I mean, you know, a lot of people, first thing you say about cave diving, they're like, ooh, claustrophobia, but man, there's some really big passage in these caves and You know, there's also some really small passage, of course, but, you know, as a general rule of thumb, there's a lot of really big open caves that are just beautiful, perfect, clear water, and just, you know, truly mind-blowing.
Well, you know what? I love talking to you about this. I find it so fascinating. I wish we could go on for another hour, but we've already burned up our time. Can you close us out with just pick one of your favorite dives and walk us through how that went?
It's supposed to be a sump dive that we were doing in Alabama. It was a sump is where it goes underwater and then it comes up into dry cave where you would then, you know, cave as you would normally, like above water. And so we went into this under this spring. It's one of those springs that was flooded. And so it had all these really awesome formations. I mean, it was just, you know, you felt like you were in Mexico, or something other than, you know, the really cold water. But, you felt like you were, you know, in Mexico from all these humongous stalactites and stalagmites, and the water was beautiful. It's clear. And eventually after, I think it's about 700 feet or so, we surfaced in this big kind of dome room. We took off all of our dive gear, and we started looking around for more cave from the dome room. And through this little crack in the wall, we were able to access this other dome room. And eventually we were able to explore that back out to this massive, beautiful, like picture-perfect dry caving room that we were the first ones to ever see this. There were these, what they call rimstone pools, that were just this very, very thin pieces of rock that hold these crystal clear water. These humongous stalactites and stalagmites. And, I mean, it was just truly like breathtaking. I mean, it was the coolest thing ever to be the first one there to see such beauty under the ground. And, you know, all it took was a 20-minute cave dive to go through and a little bit of effort to get up and through the cave to see this. I mean, it was just, you know, it was like, wow, you know, that's why I got in the cave dive. And that's exactly what I'm looking for.
Mm, boy, that does sound really, really cool. You know, you mentioned some fragile formations there. What about conservation, taking care of these places?
Yeah, so that's a big part of cave diving. The National Speleological Society does a lot of great work for cave conservation, and they do a lot of instruction on how to cave and cave lightly, as you will, and how to protect these caves, because, you know, these formations and stuff have been forming for years and years and years, and can all be gone by just somebody just wanting to remove it from the cave, or just being careless and popping into it. And so, you know, what happens underground affects us above ground too, though. You know, these water systems that we're diving are part of, a lot of the times, part of the drinking water that you know, we're using every day, the water that we're taking showers in and cooking with and things like that. And so, you know, when companies and stuff want to access these springs or put pipelines that's going to interfere with the flow of these springs and all these aquifers, you know, it's important that we not just, you know, say, okay, cool, do it, because, you know, this affects us too. So we, we like to try and educate everybody on the importance of caves and underwater caves, and help them to understand that these are important, and just, you know, carelessly placing stuff on top of them and just, you know, kind of neglecting their existence, it's just not beneficial. So there's animals that live in these caves. There's microorganisms that are, potentially help us in the future. I mean, there's a lot of benefits from these caves, and I think it's important for everybody to know that.
I love it that you guys not only know how to take care of the natural environment, but that you can promote it for others too and help wake the rest of us up, because what we're doing on the surface is impacting what's beneath. Not something a lot of people think about.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of hydrologists and stuff that are able to test water and find, they do what's called dye tracing and see you know, some of these caves are connected, though they're just miles and miles away from each other. They're still hydrogeologically connected. And so if you may be building something, you know, 10 miles down the road, but this water is all connected. So it may be far away from the public out there, but because they're connected through water, it's, you know, it will affect people that are, you know, 10 miles away. And so it's just, it's super important that we, just not neglect their existence, and that we, you know, make sure we're taking care of them and doing our part.
Yeah. Cool stuff. So how can people find out more information? I know you have a blog out there that if people are interested, they can see some of the pictures and the videos and read more stories about some of these dives. Great resource. So how can people find you?
So I try to maintain a blog, hobbyistexplorer.blogspot.com. It's where I try and post some of the dives and caves that we go into. And then cave.org is a great resource for caving. That's the NSS direct website. You can learn, you can get on everything of exploration, studying, and finding like a caving club near you as well. You know, there's a lot of local grottos in all these states. But if you've always, you know, kind of been interested in caving, you know, these grottos will, you know, lend you a helmet, light, and you guys can go see some beautiful stuff underground. And then cave diving wise, there's great resource is nsscds.org, and that's the direct website for the cave diving section of the NSS. And from there, they do they have all the information for training, conservation, safety, some really good photos. I think they've got a forum as well, so a lot of good stuff there. And then you know, feel free to contact me if you ever have any questions. I can hopefully point you in the right direction.
Right on. So help us out a little bit. You say NSF, so National Speleological. So N is in Nancy, S is in Sam, F is in Frank.
And then CDS.org. And that's C as in cat, D as in dog, and then S as in safety.org.
Right on. And once again, your blog is hobbyistexplorer.blogspot.com. And man, I plan to spend some time there this winter doing some armchair spelunking with you.
Very cool. Well, I'm really happy to be able to get on the show, and big fan of the show. Listen every week. So keep up the good work.
Oh, thanks, man. We love having you on, and I love talking cave diving. I feel like we just scratched the surface. Would you be willing to come back on again at some point in the future, and we can dive into more amazing stories about your experiences?
Definitely. I would love to come back on and share some good stories and some of the projects that I'm sometimes able to help with.
Oh, fantastic. That'd be great. Well, thanks again for your time. And for all of our listeners out there, you know what I'm going to say. Get out there and have some fun. You know, cave diving. Wow. It's like a part of the earth that we know so little about. You think about our own planet and what, you know, what is underground and what's left to be found for the very first time. A lot of explorers these days go to places that have all been explored out before. They just try to do it in a new way. But if you get into something like this, it's like Josh said, you could do something for the very first time that no one has ever done before. What a cool idea. So make sure you do get out there. Have some fun.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to growing the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.